In deze podcast spreek ik met professor in celbiologie en fysiologie en tevens auteur van het boek Why We Get Sick, Dr. Ben Bigman. Dr. Ben Bigman, welcome to the Keto Podcast.
Thank you, Louisette. I am delighted to join you.
Yes, well, thank you so much for joining me today. And I believe I might have stalked you a little bit since the very first time I met you in Switzerland last summer. But I'm very happy you said yes and that you took the time to be my guest here today. The main reason that I'm so happy to have you here is that I hope to make it very clear to the audience that insulin sensitivity, insulin resistance is such an important factor in everybody's health, and that when you understand this even just a little bit, that there are simple things you can do to improve your health for the long run. And this is not only important for healthcare professionals, but also for anyone who's dealing with health issues and is looking for a way to get healthy again. But let's just kick off with your book. You have it behind you, but I have it here as well. You can tell I've been reading a lot. it's called Why We Get Sick, and I think it's been out for a couple of years already, since 2020, mm-hmm. I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So can you tell us about how you came to writing this book?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Thanks again for inviting me on. Right, the book was a bit of a journey for me, where it was the culmination or the end result of a few different things that were happening, that was happening in my life at the time, but all with one goal, which was to share ideas. And so increasingly, as a professor and a scientist, I was a little worried at the traditional way of doing things, which is, as a scientist, you make some neat discoveries, you have an interesting idea, and then you write a scientific manuscript that will be published in a scientific journal that no one will ever read. And I thought, this is not the best way to do things. If these ideas are valuable, I need to have a way of showing and sharing these ideas with the average person in a way that they can understand it. And that was the beginning of me writing a book. It's not common for biomedical scientists in my field to write books. That's not something we do. We just write these science manuscripts that get published in science journals. And so the book itself is a bit of an anomaly. It's not something that happens very often, but I needed to do it just to prove to myself that these are our ideas that actually matter. So much of what happens in universities doesn't matter. We pretend it does, but it doesn't really have any relevance in the real world. I wanted to believe that these ideas bouncing in my head did have relevance. And then all of it was simply a vehicle, a way to share my ideas about insulin resistance. I was a little worried that this was something that you never heard people talk about, that if you were a patient, you never heard your clinician talk about it. The patient, the average individual, wasn't aware of it and wasn't aware of how common it was or how it contributes to all of these chronic diseases. So all of those ideas got wrapped into the book, basically. The simplest way of describing it being, it's a book that helps you understand what insulin resistance is, where it comes from, why it matters, namely, what are all the diseases that come from insulin resistance? And then lastly, it's the good news, which is what to do about it.
Yeah. Yes. And could you explain, before we dive any deeper, could you explain a little bit more about what insulin resistance is and why it plays such a big role for our health?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Insulin resistance is a problem with two parts. So it really is essential to understand that it's as if I'm holding a coin and the coin has two sides. So too does insulin resistance. You won't have one without the other. And on one side of the coin is the resistance to insulin itself. And to understand that, we have to really zoom down to the level of a cell. And every cell of the body, of the billions of cells in our bodies, every cell has an insulin receptor. Or a doorway that only insulin can come and knock on. And so it's a very important hormone. There are not a lot of hormones that will affect literally every cell. Insulin is one of them. And insulin will do different things at different cells. It's not one thing only. It may be the same door, but what happens when insulin knocks on the door is very different and varies based on the cell. Now, the insulin resistance part of this problem is where insulin isn't working very well at some cells of the body. Now, there are some cells of the body where insulin is working perfectly well, but not all of them. Now, then the second part matters, which is if we flip the coin over, now we go out of the level of the cell and go back to the view of the whole body. At this point, the second part of insulin resistance is relevant, which is that insulin levels are much, much higher throughout the body. So the blood levels of insulin is elevated, and this is a condition called hyperinsulinemia. In these instances of insulin resistance contributing to disease, to truly understand how insulin resistance contributes to disease, insulin resistance, which is again the problem with two parts to it, the coin with two sides, you need to appreciate both of those sides. So as an example, we could, to follow up on the second part of your question, how does it contribute to disease? Let's just take a common problem like high blood pressure or hypertension. That is one of the leading risk factors for heart disease, and heart disease is one of the leading causes of death. Insulin resistance, remember being two things, can contribute to hypertension by nature of both of those specific problems. So on one hand, for example, you have the high insulin part of insulin resistance. And when insulin goes up, it activates the release of another hormone called aldosterone. And so high insulin is pushing up high aldosterone. And if aldosterone's high, aldosterone is forcing the kidneys to retain too much water. And if the kidneys are retaining too much water, then the amount of blood we have, the blood volume goes up. And if volume goes up, pressure goes up as well. And now we have hypertension. But at the same time that is happening, the other part of insulin resistance is also relevant, which is where insulin isn't working very well. And in this case, again, staying just with hypertension, insulin, when it works well, when the blood vessel itself is insulin sensitive, insulin will come to the blood vessel, knock on the door of the insulin receptor, and tell the blood vessel to expand, to dilate. And if blood vessels dilate, blood pressure will go down. However, because the blood vessel itself becomes resistant to insulin, now it doesn't do that anymore. It's not listening to what insulin's trying to do. And so the blood vessel stays constricted. And if the blood vessel is constricted, then the pressure goes up. It's pressing in more. And so there's more pressure. So even in within the same problem, like hypertension, we can see that the two different parts of insulin resistance are each distinctly relevant, but they would always be happening at the same time because insulin resistance is always a problem of two parts.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much. And is it just eating too many carbs too often, or are there other causes for insulin resistance?
Yeah, there are a few different ways to look at the origins of insulin resistance, and I'll summarize them. So firstly, we have the three primary causes of insulin resistance. And these are causes of insulin resistance that are independent of any other stimulus. They are capable of causing insulin resistance all on their own, and have been validated as real causes in every experimental model, whether it's cells growing in a petri dish, whether it's laboratory rodents like mice and rats, or whether it's humans. And those three primary causes are stress, namely an elevation in stress hormones like cortisol and epinephrine, inflammation. So when the immune system is overactive, that will contribute to or directly cause insulin resistance. And then lastly, to follow up on the point you just made with regards to carb consumption, it's chronically elevated insulin. Now, there's a lot of misunderstanding on that point where people will say, Ben, you're just trying to say that any insulin spike is bad or any glucose spike is bad. That's not what I'm saying. I really want to emphasize that I'm saying chronic elevations in insulin. Now, back to dietary carbs, there are studies in humans to show that if you simply overfeed carbohydrates, you over just the course of 1 week, their fasting insulin levels will go up by 2.5 times. That is a perfect definition or a perfect example of insulin resistance. So one individual glucose and insulin spike is generally irrelevant. But if it continues to happen, then it becomes more and more relevant because the more insulin is climbing more frequently, the more resistant you become to it. And that's important because we think of the insulin spike as just this individual little peak. It's gone up and gone down. That's not the way it works. Even in an insulin sensitive person, insulin will often be elevated above the fasting condition if you eat refined starches and sugars for up to 3 hours. That is for an insulin sensitive person. And so by the time insulin comes down, if the person isn't eating, if they are uncommon and they're taking a 4 to 5 hour break between when they're eating, then at least there's some period of time where insulin has been able to come back down. But in an insulin resistant person, that insulin from that same bunch of carbohydrates could stay elevated for up to 5 hours. And of course, this is the same person who very, very likely, after they eat their very starchy, sugary breakfast, insulin has spiked considerably. It's gone up several times higher than it should have compared to an insulin sensitive person. And even before it's started to peak and come down, they're ready 2 hours later for their mid-morning snack. And then they have some sugary drink or some sugary packaged food. And so then they do it again for lunch and again for their afternoon snack and again for dinner and again for their evening snack. And so the average individual, because the average individual is insulin resistant, certainly in the US and many other parts of the world, lesser so in Western Europe and Eastern Europe, but still not great. But the average individual is spending every waking moment in a state of elevated insulin and even several hours into their non-waking moments. And that is what's heavily contributing to insulin resistance. So, of the three causes I just mentioned, I very much want the last one to be the one that sticks in people's minds. There's only so much you can do about stress. It's very difficult to know what the cause of stress may be, and it's even more difficult to change it. It's very difficult to know what the source of inflammation may be in someone's body. It is not hard to know why someone has elevated insulin. It's because they're eating refined starches and sugars too often. And that is resulting in too frequent spikes of insulin. And when you start to stack them all together, now they do have this chronic elevation in insulin. And if insulin stays high for too long, it will cause insulin resistance.
Yes, exactly. So the most obvious solution to this would be changing your diet.
That's exactly right. Yes. And again, that's the reason why I focus on that variable so much. It's difficult to control stress. It's difficult to control inflammation. It is not difficult. Well, it's simple. The idea is simple to control insulin through controlling carbohydrate consumption, but that doesn't mean it's easy because when we start talking about diet, we then start talking about deep habits or even, dare I say, addictions. Because of the three macronutrients in the diet, proteins, fats, and carbohydrates, only one of them has been shown to have an addictive property to it. There's no evidence to suggest people are addicted to protein. There's no evidence to suggest people are addicted to fat alone. And there is substantial evidence to suggest that carbohydrates are addictive, whether they're on their own or whether they come with fat. That's a particularly delicious combination. But that does not vilify fat. It vilifies the carbohydrate because that is the common denominator. So as much as I say that it's a simple concept, that does not mean it's easy. I want people to know that I have nothing but empathy for those who hear this and have been listening to you already for a while, and then they're thinking, yeah, but it's still so difficult because you're talking about addictions and habits. It is difficult, and I understand that, but it is the fight worth fighting. That is the variable worth focusing on the most.
And I hear you talking about fats, proteins, and carbohydrates. What role does seed oil play in this whole diet?
It's very appropriate and good that there has been so much focus on seed oils in recent years. And I would direct everyone who wants to learn more. One of the best sources for me has been a person on social media. His name is Tucker Goodrich. He is an authority on this topic, and I would direct anyone to him. My focus has been to simply look at the role of seed oils, particularly the omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acid, linoleic acid. That is the fat that is most prevalent in these refined seed oils, and it appears to be the fat that is most problematic. The role of linoleic acid in insulin resistance is not as clear to me in those as it is with those three other primary causes. So I consider linoleic acid to be a secondary cause. Now, I say that because if you treat, fat cells, if you incubate fat cells with linoleic acid, they will manifest insulin resistance. Now, as you go up through the experimental models, it becomes a little less clear. For example, if you have a human eat linoleic acid as part of their diet, there's no direct evidence that I'm aware of, that that's directly causing insulin resistance. And so it starts to fall apart a little bit. However, there is evidence to show that linoleic acid will accumulate in fat cells if you start eating more of it, which most people do. It is the most commonly consumed fat on the planet, certainly in the West, actually, even in the East, it's everywhere. As we have waged war on animal fats, it's these seed oils that have been a very a strong, common replacement. So, again, most of the fat people eat comes from these refined seed oils, and they are everywhere. Certainly in the West, try to find a salad dressing, for example, without seed oils. Good luck. The seed oils, as you consume more, the linoleic acid will accumulate more in the fat cell, and that has been shown to metabolize. The linoleic acid will become a metabolite. It gets altered, and as it gets altered, it becomes very problematic. And among the many negative consequences of this, one is that it will prevent fat cells, it will force fat cells to grow through a process called hypertrophy. It limits a fat cell's ability to multiply. Now, that might sound like a good thing, but the reality is that if you force a fat cell to grow through hypertrophy, you're forcing it to become very insulin resistant. That's a more of a nuanced layer to insulin resistance, which is if you're looking at the origin of insulin resistance from the tissues of the body, the fat cell is generally going to be the first that becomes insulin resistant. And these linoleic acid metabolites are a key contributor to disrupting the ability of the fat cell to grow in a different way, forcing it to grow through hypertrophy, which then becomes very pro-inflammatory and very insulin resistant.
Yeah. Wow. So that's like a blessing in disguise, the seed oils. Yeah. No, not blessing, a curse in disguise.
Yeah, that's
Yeah.
right.
Insulin resistance is quite a new thing for many people. Even many healthcare professionals are not really aware of it, like you just said. How can anyone discover if they are insulin resistant?
One easy way of determining insulin resistance is to look at just your blood pressure. If someone has high blood pressure and it's consistent, you see it every day, that's very likely to be caused by insulin resistance. Now, that is not to say every instance of high blood pressure is a result of insulin resistance, because there can be other causes like caffeine or sleep deprivation. But insulin resistance is a big one, and that's low-hanging fruit, if you will, because we were talking about high blood pressure earlier. Another one is to look at how you're storing your fat. And if you measure the largest part of your waist, so usually right around your belly, the largest part around your belly, and if you times that by two, so belly circumference times two, that number, if it is higher than your height, then that suggests a problem. It suggests that you have too much fat that is stored, and fat around the center of the body is typically more problematic, because where we store fat matters tremendously. With regards to how insulin resistant those fat cells are inclined to become. So high blood pressure is one. A high waist times two number, if it goes beyond your height, that is also a problem. And there are a handful of others, and maybe I'll just end with one that's a little more clinical, which is if your fasting insulin number itself is higher, and with European numbers, it's about high 20s, 27, 28 picomole. If your insulin is higher than that, that's a warning sign. That suggests that something may be wrong.
Yeah.
But of course, you have to get a blood test to do that. So the first tests I mentioned are a little simpler.
Yes, that's going to be my next question. What lab tests can you do to determine insulin resistance?
Yeah,
Fasted
so
insulin, yeah.
the best one is your fasted insulin. And then once you have fasted insulin, you can look at your fasting glucose as well, and then you can put that into a formula called the HOMA, HOMA, and that will change a little bit based on your numbers that you're using, whether it's US metric units or whether it's European units. But you can find that online. Look up so your fasted insulin, your fasted glucose, and find your HOMA index or your HOMA score. And then another one that someone could do at home is simply to fast overnight. If you do about a 16-hour fast and you measure, or even certainly a 24-hour fast, and you measure your ketones, if you do a 24-hour fast and you find that you cannot detect any ketones or that you're not in ketosis, that is a warning sign that your insulin is too high. Now, I'm sure your audience knows this already, but I will just mention it briefly. The connection there is that ketones are a product of fat burning. If the body's burning a lot of fat, the body's making ketones from that fat. But the body can only be burning a lot of fat if the hormone insulin is low. And if insulin is low, that indicates that you're insulin sensitive. If you're insulin resistant, your insulin is staying high for too long, that will inhibit your body's ability to burn fat, which will then inhibit your body's ability to create ketones. So simply getting into ketosis after a fast is another good sign of a body being insulin sensitive.
Yes, and does that mean that the faster you get into ketosis, the more insulin sensitive you are?
Yes,
Yeah,
that's
good.
right.
I'm good then. Well, insulin has a very bad reputation, and like you just said, it's also a very important hormone for the body. And I understand that not all insulin resistance is a problem right away. Can you explain the difference between pathological and physiological insulin resistance?
Oh, I would be delighted to. I'm so happy you're asking that. Yes, so there is a normal natural role for insulin resistance, which, as you noted, is termed physiological insulin resistance, as opposed to what we've been talking about, as you mentioned, pathological. So there's a version of insulin resistance that is disease and promoting chronic illness. Then there's a version of insulin resistance which happens on purpose, and the purpose of which is to promote growth. So within the life of a human, there are two periods of substantial or even explosive growth. And they are the two P's, as I teach my students, the two P's of physiological insulin resistance, namely puberty and pregnancy. So during adolescence, the child is turning into an adult and there is substantial growth, not only in height, but girth. Tissues are just growing substantially to the point that you might not even recognize a kid 2 or 3 years later. They've grown, they've had so much growth. And then second, of course, is pregnancy, where mom's body, the mother's body, is changing dramatically, very quickly. Lots of change in with regards to growth throughout the body, as well as growth for the baby. Baby needs to grow substantially, especially at the end of the trimester. Once all the tissues are developed, then it's just time to grow. And it's no surprise then that if the insulin resistance is promoting growth, the growth of the fetus happens most explosively at the last trimester. Well, and that is when mom has become the most insulin resistant. So the higher insulin is promoting more growth. And in those instances where the growth is happening by design, it's a good thing. So that is physiological insulin resistance. But even still, you will have those two parts of the definition are still relevant. Namely, insulin isn't quite working the same way at every tissue that it used to, and blood insulin levels are higher. If someone is trying to invoke the term of physiological insulin resistance, but insulin levels are low, they are wrong. That is not physiological insulin resistance. Like, for example, sometimes people will say that a ketogenic diet will cause physiological insulin resistance. That is absolutely incorrect. That is not true. Their insulin levels are exquisitely low. And if you were to inject a bolus of insulin from a syringe into this person, they're so insulin sensitive that they would pass out because their glucose levels would drop so quickly. They're very insulin sensitive. Now, however, where does that myth come from, where we say that a ketogenic diet causes physiological insulin resistance? It's because they have become temporarily glucose intolerant. And by that, I mean, if you take an average individual who eats carbs all the time and they go in and, but they're healthy still, they're insulin sensitive, but they eat a normal higher carb diet. And they go in and take an oral glucose tolerance test. They go in and drink 75 grams of pure glucose in their doctor's office. And then they have their blood measured for 2 hours or 3 hours. And then the clinician looks at the glucose levels. Normally, at around 2 hours, the glucose level should have come back down to normal. And so let's take a person who had been eating a normal traditional diet with lots of carbs. They go in and pass that test. But for whatever reason, maybe to control their migraine headaches, they want to adopt a ketogenic diet. And so they do. Now they go and do this oral glucose tolerance test 6 months later, and now they fail the test. Their glucose levels did not get back down to normal at 120 minutes. It took them 180 minutes or something. And so you'd look at this and say, ah, they're insulin resistant now because insulin wasn't working as well to correct the glucose. That's not true. What happens is that the beta cells, which are the cells that produce insulin, become so efficient that they get rid of a lot of the insulin that they have on hand. So briefly, when we eat a bunch of carbohydrate and our blood glucose levels spike, insulin will get released in two phases. Yeah. There's a first phase and a second phase. And the first phase is made up of all of the insulin that the beta cells already have made and have prepackaged, ready to go.
Yeah.
Then the second phase is all of the insulin that the beta cells make from scratch. They make it fresh, de novo. They make it fresh. And now they start releasing it, all in an effort to really fine tune the glucose and bring it back down to normal. But again, as I noted, the beta cells are so efficient that if a person hasn't eaten carbohydrates within, even just within 24 hours, it's very fast, the beta cells will say, hey, I don't need all of this insulin here. I'm going to break it all down. But then all of a sudden, there's this big load of glucose that comes in, and the beta cells realize that they are ill-prepared, and then they sound the alarm, full alarm. We need to start making insulin, but even still, it's a little too late because we've missed that first phase. We needed all of that prepackaged insulin, and now we only have the second phase, which is good enough to get the job done, but it takes longer to get the job done on its own. So if someone adheres to a ketogenic diet and they need to go in and take an oral glucose tolerance test, then you need to eat some carbs at least about 6 to 8 hours before you go in and take the test. You need to remind your beta cells that they need to have some insulin ready to go, and then you will pass the glucose tolerance test perfectly fine.
Yes, well, it's great you just explained that like this, because last year we've been doing the oral glucose tolerance test with several people, around 80 people, and we also measured their insulin. And we would have people eating a regular Western diet, and we would have people eating a ketogenic or a low carb diet. And this is exactly what we saw. But the interesting thing is that the people who ate a low carb or ketogenic diet, who were very insulin sensitive, they would have a small rise in their insulin in the second phase. And it would be so effective because right away, glucose would come down. So even if they have a late response, it just works like
still works.
Like clockwork.
Yeah. Well, and another consideration, especially in the Netherlands, is the body mass of a person too. This is something that's bothered me about oral glucose tolerance tests, is that we always give the exact same amount of glucose to every single body.
Yeah.
And you can take, like, for example, my wife is fairly petite. She's 5'4" and 110 pounds. Her body taking in 75 grams of glucose for a pregnancy test is very, very different than a woman who's 6'2"
like
and
me.
Weighs 100. And who may weigh 160 or 170 pounds. Even they're both metabolically healthy, but there's just so much more mass, especially so much more muscle to the bigger body, that it's just so much easier for that body to clear that glucose because there's so much more tissue to pull it in. And so I very much believe if we care a lot about oral glucose tolerance tests, we need to have it be based on body weight. It needs to be a certain number of grams per kilogram body weight for me to believe that it would be more accurate. Maybe it needs to be like a half a gram per kilogram to get just to make it more even across all of the populations around the world. Because if you have a population like in the Amsterdam area in the Netherlands where everyone's just taller, it's people will be passing it even if they should be failing it. And then in contrast, you take another population, perhaps in Southeast Asia, where everyone's very slighter framed, and they're all going to be failing it, even if they're actually quite fine.
I get it. Right. Well, that brings me to another question that I had saved for the end of this interview, but this is very relevant right now because it's a question I get asked a lot, and I haven't found a very conclusive answer to it yet. And I think that very many people have been in the situation where they are steadily in ketosis, and all of a sudden they are at a party or in some situation where they're tempted to eat something very rich in sugar, like a piece of cake or an ice cream or some chocolate. I think we've all been there. And then they just drop out of ketosis. And I get a lot of people asking me, is that dangerous? Is it dangerous to suddenly drop out of ketosis by eating lots of sugar? Could that spike your triglycerides? Could it be a danger for your cardiovascular health? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, my thoughts are that it is not dangerous, that there's nothing that's going to result in acute illness or dramatically in that moment increase the risk of heart disease or something. No. My worry more is the ability of the person to let that be the exception. That there are people based on like what we were talking earlier, namely people who struggle with addiction. This wonderful quote that I always come back to by a Catholic saint, Saint Augustine, said, "Abstinence is easier than perfect moderation." That within the realm of diet and nutrition, people will say, "Well, you can eat whatever, just moderation in all things." It sounds so beautiful. And yet, for someone who struggles with addiction, it is not beautiful. It is terrible advice. Imagine telling an alcoholic that, "Well, it's fine. Just drink only one glass of wine and then stop." But that's the problem. They cannot stop. So, to answer the question in a bit of a strange way, no, there's no inherent danger to that indulgence, that insulin glucose spike. Your body will correct it and deal with it very quickly. However, it's the concern that it starts to turn into another indulgence and then another. And then the person who's worked so hard to make the progress they have, they may find that they start to lose it. Because of this one event, they weren't able to just stop. Maybe at that party they stopped at one, but it lights up their brain and they get home, or on their way home, they stop and order more junk food and then just start indulging. And before you know it, they've lost their progress. So I think the physiological response to the food itself is not problematic. The potential problem is more that it starts to work against the person's self-discipline because they struggle with addictive tendencies.
Great question. So I can put a lot of people at ease now. That's not directly dangerous. One other thing you said earlier on about coffee, because there are many people who say that coffee is downright dangerous for your health, and others say it contributes to your health. What are your thoughts on that?
Right. So that's a good question. The epidemiological data tend to be somewhat conflicting, where it seems like every other week you hear about one study that suggests coffee drinking is bad, and then the next week you hear of a big study that suggests coffee is good. These are always based on big population surveys, which are garbage studies. I believe they should never be relied on for any conclusive takeaway. That you can only speculate. It's only coincidence, is what those kinds of studies show. So, my general thoughts on coffee and other kind of caffeinated beverages that people will be drinking is that the dose matters, where caffeine itself, maybe I'll just speak to the kind of metabolic consequences. Caffeine itself has a good and a bad. I mean, the one thing is to acknowledge that it is addictive. And so, a person needs to be mindful of their habits and addictions. And that can be very difficult to be objectively mindful of it. So we have to maybe recruit some help to know how bad a problem may be. But with caffeine, it has both the benefit of activating lipolysis, which is fat burning, and thus it is in fact more ketogenic. You do get a ketogenic spike, from caffeine. But at the same time, the main molecule, the main hormone that's doing this is epinephrine. And epinephrine is a stress hormone. So when I was talking about stress earlier, what the stress hormones do is they want to increase glucose. And if that's happening too much too often, it's no surprise that caffeine can also cause some insulin resistance. It's forcing the hormone insulin to not work very well. So caffeine can have a good and a bad side. And I would say at lower, more modest doses, it probably is more good, metabolically speaking. And then at the higher doses, as some people get to, especially when you're mixing it with lots of different sugar, like especially people do in the US, or you and even through the West, actually even in the East, frankly, everywhere, people dump so much sweetener or sugar into their coffee. That is taking it too far, where the epinephrine and the sugar could be contributing to an overall negative metabolic response.
Exactly. All right, and we were talking about lab tests earlier on, and there's another one I'd like to pick your brain about. Well, as you know, that when people enter ketosis, a lot of things change in the metabolism, and one of those is that acidity rises in the body, and this brings a few problems for people who already have higher acid levels. And as we know, it can also lead to higher uric acid levels that can cause things like gout, for example. Would it be a good idea to monitor uric levels when you start ketogenic diet?
Yeah, there is. So, Louis said you mentioned a couple important points. Let me just talk about acidity and pH, and then let's talk about uric acid. So, acidity or the pH changes in the body are incredibly uncommon. It's practically impossible for someone to eat or drink something that will change their pH. The pH of the blood is so important to the body that there are a lot of mechanisms to keep it in a very narrow range. Now, so there's no evidence that I'm aware of that a ketogenic diet or any kind of diet will change overall pH. It may shift very, very slightly, but it will always stay in a normal range, in this range of homeostasis. Now, uric acid is important, and I would invite everyone listening who's curious about this to look up the work of my very good friend Richard Johnson at the University of Colorado. He is the authority on uric acid and the metabolic consequences. And in fact, we are collaborating on a project to address the very thing you're talking about right now, which is the tendency in some people to adopt a ketogenic diet and see that uric acid goes up. Now, uric acid, as a brief background, my interest in uric acid comes from the fact that uric acid can cause insulin resistance in every biomedical model. Now, someone would ask, well, then why didn't I include uric acid in my list of primary causes of insulin resistance? Why do I call it a secondary cause? It's because uric acid causes insulin resistance through inflammation. And so if you get rid of the inflammation, you get rid of the insulin resistance. And this is what we're studying with Dr. Johnson, where we see in some people uric acid levels go up with a ketogenic diet, but also we know people who adopt a ketogenic diet have a reduction in their inflammatory cytokines like C-reactive protein or TNF alpha or interleukin-1 beta. All of these pro-inflammatory proteins go down with adoption of a ketogenic diet. Well, how do we reconcile that? If uric acid is going up and it causes inflammation, which it does, how do we see that actual markers of inflammation are going down, even in the same person who may be seeing an increase in uric acid? It's because of the ketones. This is what we're about to publish. We find that ketones can block the inflammation that the uric acid is trying to cause. And so even if they see this uric acid change, it's the ketones that are blocking it from doing anything else. And so that appears to kind of offset the uric acid. But even still, it's important to note that it is not a universal phenomenon that a ketogenic diet increases uric acid. That happens in some people, doesn't happen in others. And I don't know why we have this difference. But even in those who do see an increase in uric acid, we don't see an increase in inflammation. And it appears to be that it's the ketones that are blocking that from going any further.
Amazing. So would there be a role in measuring uric acid in certain people?
I do think it is valuable to measure uric acid. And just as a matter of experimentation, I get my blood drawn about every 3 to 4 months. And my uric acid levels have always been in the normal range. So I've never been overtly worried about them. But lately, I've been taking more, just as an experiment, more allulose. And allulose is a rare sugar that is a version of fructose that has a carbon molecule with a flipped hydroxyl unit. So it's kind of like an evil, sorry, the fructose is the evil twin of allulose being the good twin. They are almost identical molecules, but very different metabolic effects. In fact, it's because of the similarity that allulose appears to be so beneficial, because one of the most common causes of uric acid is fructose metabolism. Now, back to my story about my own blood tests, they've always been normal uric acid levels, but over the past 3 months, I've been taking much more allulose. And I found that my uric acid levels are now so low that it went below the range. And so it dropped below. And we have a case study that we're going to likely publish of a woman whose uric acid levels have been several times too high. Even with a low carb ketogenic diet, it was always just persistently elevated. She started taking allulose and it dropped. Now, I know there are some challenges getting allulose in Europe. Hopefully that gets solved soon. But anyone who can, my favorite source is a company called RX Sugar. They make allulose products that are absolutely delicious. So anyone who can get them, I can, I don't want to say a guarantee, but if someone is struggling with their uric acid, it is very, very likely that allulose will bring their uric acid levels down substantially and very quickly.
Great, very interesting. Now let's hope the EU will
I
soon lift
know.
that ban. Yeah. Okay. Let me see. I had loads of questions, but I think you've already answered quite a lot of them. Well, there are so many more questions I would love to ask you, but I don't want to go too deep in now. Right now, there are so many links between insulin sensitivity and the whole range of health problems, and I suggest that anyone who wants to learn more about this just buys the book and reads all the wisdom that's in there. And I have only one very big wish. Can we get it in Dutch?
Oh my gosh, I would. So I wish I had control over this. This is all I can say. Anyone who's listening, if you know a Dutch publisher, then that's how it has to happen. The Dutch publisher will contact my publisher and then they make the deal. I want to see it in every language, especially Dutch. I can't wait. I'm so looking forward to coming and visiting this the Netherlands this summer with my family. We love it there. It's such a beautiful place.
Great. And I mean, there's no other book like this. There's nothing else. So we just need this in Dutch. Well, there are so many things that are going to my mind right now, but just let's just round this up. Besides buying the book, where can people go and find more about your work?
Yes. Thank you again so much. All this means, Louisette, is that we need to do a number two soon, a round two. Yes, people can find me and everything I'm doing at my website, insuliniq.com. At insuliniq.com, I have links to all of my social media posts. I have a calendar that shows my upcoming talks, including some in Europe this summer. I'll be in London, and then I'll be in Switzerland. I'm giving formal science talks, so people can find everything I'm doing and all of our work, my work at insuliniq.com.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on this podcast today. And I will definitely keep following your work. I think you just created a lot more fans here in the Netherlands and Belgium, too. So thank you very much. And I hope to talk to you someday again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ik hoop dat je dit een mooie en informatieve podcast vond. En vol trots kan ik zeggen dat dit de 65e aflevering is van de Keto Podcast. En dat we al meer dan 200.000 downloads hebben inmiddels. Met per aflevering wel honderden tot duizenden luisteraars. En ik wil jou als luisteraar echt enorm bedanken voor het luisteren. Want ik kan wel een podcast willen maken, maar als er niemand luistert, dan heeft het weinig zin. Dat er zoveel mensen luisteren en me zelfs laten weten dat ze er wat aan hebben, dat ze er iets van leren en dat ze zelfs fan zijn, nou dat doet me echt wel wat. Dus nogmaals, dank je wel. En je kunt helpen de podcast nog verder te verspreiden door op Spotify of iTunes of waar je dan ook luistert een waardering te geven van 5 sterren. En dat maakt de podcast nog beter zichtbaar bij nog meer mensen. En ik vind het ook superleuk als je een mooie review achterlaat. De Keto Podcast is ook op YouTube te vinden tegenwoordig en daar kun je je abonneren en ook een leuke reactie achterlaten. Het helpt me allemaal om door te blijven gaan. En dan ga ik nu afronden. Mijn naam is Louisa Blikkenhorst. Dankjewel voor het luisteren
En graag tot de volgende keer.